Hello everyone, thanks so much for being here on freezing cold Monday night. So yeah, we've sold out of books, so I'm really sorry for that. But the main thing is that we do have donation buckets tonight for Cork Sign Community. So whether you bought a book or not, everything will go towards Cork tonight. So for anyone who doesn't know, basically back in May, I started talking to a girl on Grafton Street in Dublin. She was sitting reading a book, I just started talking to her. Anyway, I asked her if she had somewhere to sleep that night, and she said she doesn't. She sleeps in a tent because the hostels are too rough and she doesn't want to get attacked and she doesn't do drugs. She didn't ask me for money or anything, we just talked for about half an hour. So, you know, it's not really new news to any of us, but at the end of the conversation, her name was also Kerry, and that's kind of what struck a chord at me. So basically, I'm sure like the rest of you, for years now, I've become more disillusioned with the Irish government. I've seen more and more people, well, especially in Dublin, begging on the streets, dying on the streets. More children, more families, and I suppose I reached a point where I decided just to do something. I am a writer, I know writers work in book trades, so I put out just like a call on social media, and I just kind of thought we might do a gig or something, like a night of poems, raise €500. But the response I received was just so phenomenal, and even though he doesn't want to take credit, Pat Cotter straight away said, the Monstration Centre put €500 towards the book, and then like that it just spread. Paul very kindly offered to have an event, and here we are finally, like 6 months later. And I suppose the main thing is that like it's just been a very emotional process. What the book also contains is writings from people who are in the services of the Dublin Sign Community, and I had to get permission to use these pieces, and in some cases, by the time they asked people, the people would die in the street. So I'm sorry to bring it down to like a morbid tone, but that's the reality. And then I arrived down in Cork on Friday to read at the Winter Warmer Festival, and I was staying in McCurtain Street, and I walked down to Washington Street, and kind of to my dismay, I saw the situation is the same here. I saw about 8 different people begging, paper cups, doorways, hopefully alive. I noticed on the way here tonight that opposite the Merchant's Quay Club Centre, there's a man who seems to have built like a cardboard fort. He's been there the last 3 nights I've seen him. And it's just awful. In this society, in this country, there are human beings dying in the streets. And it's something I just really want to change. So as much as, you know, it's like, come and buy a book, the book's all out. I think this all started by me talking to a girl sitting on the ground. So what I would say is, thanks so much for your donations tonight, but please do talk to people, do what you can, spread the word about this, because this just shouldn't be happening. People will die this winter, but hopefully this book will make a difference. But I think just our awareness about this, just as a society, it can happen to any one of us, you know, and even that girl, the reality is she's still proceeding to my property. You know what I mean? That's just where we're at. So I'm sorry to get very serious about it, but you know. Anyway, I remember years ago, Paul Casey, when I was a younger poet, asked me to read down at O'Vale, and like he did this weekend again, he made sure I had somewhere to stay, I had breakfast fed, you know, paid me for my reading, all these kind of things, walked me home, made sure I was safe. And that meant so much to me at the time, but I had no idea just how much that, you know, his reasons for doing that will become more apparent when he reads his piece later on. So what we're going to have tonight is a poem by Patrick Cotter, and then a short story read by the amazing Madeline Darcy, and then Paul will read his piece at the end, which I think you'll all find very moving. And yeah, so all I'll say is, yes, basically, having seen how bad it is in Cork and how freezing it is, I kind of like went up and harassed Cork's own community. They didn't know who I was, which day I was like, give me buckets, come on, like a mad person. And they did, and they tweeted about it and stuff, and they seem to be a great team there. So again, this Christmas I would urge you, I don't know if they do it down here like they do in Dublin, they donate shoeboxes, all this kind of stuff, hats, clothes, underwear, scarves. Yeah, I would just say please do spread the word and do something, because we can't let this continue. So yeah, anyway, thank you very much. If you do want to buy the book, lookingatthestars.ie, that's all the information there. But again, if you can, please just do talk to me on the street. And here we have Pat Cotter. Thanks.
Yeah, I think a society which can't afford or won't afford to educate its people or medicate its people or house its people can't be relied upon to support writers and artists either. So even on that basic selfish premise, you know, writers and artists need to demonstrate solidarity with other groups in society, and that's one of the reasons why we've got involved in this project. I have no idea what page we're on. Okay. man hauled a window all day long, slung over his shoulder like a big wooden cross. It was a sash window with 9 panes. So many people thought he was a repairman without a truck, or some recycling freak on his way home from a dumpster. But really, he was homeless, and liked to stare at the world through a window he could call his own. He shook off the occasional offer of help. Nobody else was going to get their hands on his window. At certain street corners, he would sit on the pavement and take in the view between the little square frames. On the corner of South Mall, he would admire his favourite elm tree, one with the bend to it caused by the wind. And on Sullivan's Quay, a big white and black mongrel, who could be seen at the same time each day strolling away from Toomey's shop with fat wagging tail and a packet of potatoes clenched between slobbering lips. On Pope's Quay, he placed the window on the curved top stone wall to watch the swans floating by, heads rising and lowering on their curling necks. On McCurtain Street, he watched the girls of St. Angela's in their jade uniforms, the same his dead daughter once wore. One day he stumbled, fell on his knees, then gashed his temple off the curbside to save the glass. One of the schoolgirls wiped the blood from his forehead with her handkerchief, while her classmates stood in a circle, swiping at the horrid scene through their phone screens.
There. Thank you so much. I just want to say, first of all, as I've said many times before, I really want to congratulate Paul Casey and his team for this wonderful, consistent event, which I haven't been at for ages, but I really think it's a wonderful thing. O'Vale is just a great night. And I also want to congratulate Kerry O'Brien and her sidekick, Batman Kerry, and Alice Kinsella, Robin, for doing an amazing job in only 6 months. Because when I heard about it first, I thought, oh my God, how is she going to do this? Does she realise how much work is going to be in there? And it is brilliant. It is very, very sad, though, that writers have to do these things when the government does not. There's going to be another anthology out next year, in aid of the Peter McVeary Trust, again by writers, and they really meant what they said. You know, there were no free copies to the writers even, and every single penny of that book, actually every single euro, sorry, is going straight to where it's supposed to go, which is fantastic. So well done to Munster Literature Centre and all of the other sponsors. But I'm a fiction interloper here, so thanks very much for being here. This story actually should be much longer. I had to do it in, I was very late, I was probably one of your last people. No. And also Kerry very wisely kept the fiction, the word count very low, and I can't seem to do short stories that short anymore, but for what it's worth, I think this is going to be a much longer story when it's finished, but it's called Census. I wanted to write about somebody who was not yet broken down by being homeless. So this is a young guy, and I really like him actually, but I hope you did too. The trouble was, I got way too comfortable in the old man's house. Otherwise, I'd never have opened the front door. I'd been lying on the couch in the front room with an old tartan rug over me, reading one of the old man's detective books by a fellow called Mickey Spillane, and I must have dozed off. When the doorbell rang, I was dreaming I was a small boy running fast to catch up with St. Martin de Porres and his little dog. And before I knew what I was doing, I was out in the dusty hallway, unlocking the front door. It was pelting rain outside, and the woman on the doorstep looked soaked. She was oldish and wore one of those bright yellow jackets that charity muggers wear, over a black raincoat. A heavy-looking black bag hung over her shoulder. Even her glasses were wet.
"Sorry, I've no spare change," I said, and went to pull the door closed as fast as I could. "Oh, please, hang on, I'm not looking for money, I'm your census enumerator." She smiled and held up an ID she was wearing around her neck. It looked official with her photo on it, which freaked me out. Census? I hadn't a clue what she was on about. "Everyone in Ireland has been counted on census night," she said. It was next Sunday, 24th of April, and she'd called heaps of times and posted 3 calling cards through the letterbox, and sure enough, they were lying on the hall floor amidst the flyers and takeaway menus. She went on about how the information was used for statistics only and it wouldn't take a minute. I thought I saw a curtain twitch across the street, so I brought her in and shut the door. "Good to get out of the rain," she sighed. She sat down on the couch and plonked the bag on the floor beside her. "To be honest, I'd never have taken this job if I'd known how hard it would be." She took a tissue out of her pocket and wiped her glasses. The Mickey Spillane book was on the coffee table next to the old man's pipe. "You like prime novels?" she asked. "Yeah, I've kind of got addicted to them." That was true. There was no TV, only an ancient wooden box radio. That's why I'd started reading the old lad's detective books, which normally I would never do. I'd started on Sherlock Holmes and went on to the Ruth Rendells, but I liked the Mickey Spillane ones best. They were full of action and kind of sexy in an old-fashioned way. She unzipped the bag and got out an official-looking book. "This is 6 Industry Villas, isn't it?" "Yeah." "And what's your name?" "Martin," I said. I still wasn't thinking straight. "All I have to do is ask you a few questions, then I'll come back and collect the form after census night." "Form? I can't fill out no form." "Well, it's the law, I'm afraid, but it's easy to fill out." She looked apologetic. "See, it's my granddad's house," I said, inspired. "Is your granddad in?" "Nah." "What's his name?" "William Dearborn." Thank fuck I knew it. The old lad has his name written on all his books. She wrote it down. "Do you live here too, Martin?" "Sometimes. I keep him company, like." "Could I have a contact number?" "My phone is broke." "Do you have a landline?" "Oh yeah." There was an old-fashioned phone in the kitchen. "I'll get the number." I called it out to her, but I swapped around the last 2 numbers. If there was no one here on Sunday night, she said she'd have to fill out a form instead, so I said no, it was okay, and she took out a green and white form and wrote some stuff on it and went on telling me to mark a line for yes rather than a tick and use a blue or black pen, and that in 100 years people could look up their ancestors because of the census. And I said, what do I care, sure, I'd be dead myself then. But in the end I was saying, yeah, I'd explain the whole thing to my granddad, and she could come around to collect the form the following Friday, and I let her out. Then I locked the front door and went into the kitchen. After that I was in bits. The census woman seemed nice enough, but if she guessed I was squatting, she'd probably put the law on me. She'd be back next week, and the thought of sweeping her off again made me feel sick. See, my stepfather is an abusive fucker, always telling me I'm a useless pig. After Mam died, he got worse. "Martin, you're named after a black saint. Do you know why?" "Because your whore of a mother didn't know at the time whether she was having a black baby or a white one." So I hit him. I'd have had no bother shooting him dead right then, like Mike Hammer in the Mickey Spillane books. Only I promised poor Mam I'd always try to keep out of trouble. Anyway, I didn't have a gun. So I ran out the door and walked around a while. When I crept in, he was snorting and snoring on the couch as usual. Beer cans skittled on the floor. I remembered Mam used to hide cash in the freezer. Her frozen assets, she used to call it. It was our secret. I found €30 under the frozen peas, packed a few things and fecked off. I got the bus to Cork and went straight to the Dole office, but I couldn't fill out the form. "You need a PPS number and your birth cert," the woman said. When she found out my age, she told me I couldn't get the Dole until I was 18. 8 whole weeks away. I was gutted. I slept in Penny's entrance. There's a security camera above it, so if someone pisses or pukes on you or beats you up, at least it'll be on film. Then I was in squat near the Mercy Hospital. There was a fight between some foreign fellas, so the police came and kicked us out. Next day, the place was boarded up. Then I had a stroke of luck. Two batty old ladies were chatting outside Dunn's about some old hermit man who died all alone above in Innistree Villas. There for 3 days, God rest his soul. Only for the Tesco delivery, he wouldn't have been found for weeks. I scoped the place out for ages. It was empty, all right. At the end of a terrace with a small alleyway up to the back. No lock on the side gate. Perfect. I broke the window and got in. The best thing of all was the old man's kitchen. He had two fridge freezers. One worked and the other didn't. There was only sour milk and old cheese in the fridge part of the one that worked, but there were heaps of ready meals in the freezer part. I was starving and drenched, so I put a curry into the old microwave before I checked out the second fridge. A handwritten sign, pharmacy, was sellotaped on it. But all there was inside was bottles of whiskey, cans of Coke, a box of mixed biscuits, 4 packets of Scots plant, cod liver oil and a packet of paracetamol. When I burst out laughing, it sounded strange because I hadn't laughed in ages. By the time the census lady had come, I'd made fearsome inroads on everything, but there was still some whiskey and coke left in the pharmacy, so I poured myself a drink to calm me down. It must have been reading all those detective books that inspired me, because after a while I figured I'd try to fill out the green form as if the old man was still alive, so I could keep the census woman off my back for a few weeks. So I went rootling around the house for clues. I found them all in a worn brown suitcase on top of the wardrobe in the old man's bedroom. I wrote the form in pencil first so I wouldn't feck it up. 11 questions about the house. Wasn't easy to figure them out. Person 1. William Dearborn. Date of birth? Okay. Widowed? Definitely. I had to make up some of the answers, but I managed. Person 2. Martin Dearborn. I was Martin, all right, after St. Martin de Porres. But I was no Dearborn, and I'd never had a granddad. I signed William's name on the form with a shaky black signature. I copied it from the one he wrote in his prime books. The form looked grand, only there was no space to list all the other stuff about William. About the little dog Rusty, whose collar and lead he kept. About the time he worked on the oil rigs. About his wife who died so young. I liked old William. He wasn't just some sad old fuck. I never had no granddad, and I wished I did. The census lady called back the following Friday. I can't tell you how many people made mistakes on these forms, but this is perfect, she said. The relief was massive. So was the thought that in 100 years somebody might wonder about William Dearborn and his grandson Martin, but it would take some detective to figure that one out. My stepfather, in stained pajamas, was watching daytime TV when I arrived. I said nothing to him, and he said nothing to me. I searched in my poor mom's belongings until I found my birth certificate and everything else I thought I'd need. You can fuck right off, was all he said as I was leaving. I went back to old Martin Dearborn's house. I'd remembered to take the back door key. The day I turned 18, I woke up early to get to the Dole office and be first in line. It was pelting rain outside, but I didn't care. I was a man now, and I had forms to fill. A small bit of rain wouldn't hurt me.
The institutionalized perpetuation of disparity is probably one of the atrocities of our age. that grinds us down and makes us feel incapable of helping other people because we're struggling so much ourselves, but it doesn't mean we have to lose our humanity, yeah? And we should not forget that, I think. This is really such an amazing book. I'm so blown away by this. It's so beautiful on the inside. Forget how beautiful it is on the outside. Just such quality. And I can't believe that you've done this. Congratulations, Terry. Actually, Madeline Darcy's been trying to get me to write a Cork short story for many years, and I've never managed it, but Kerry O'Brien managed to get me to write one about Dublin, which is a non-fiction piece, but I'm going to follow it back along. So thank you, Kerry, also for that. this is called Housing a Homeless Spirit, and it's autobiographical. Where are you from, Boyle? You're not from Cork. You can't be. Not with an accent like that. There must be endless reasons for being homeless. Countless forms of homelessness. 100 million people, physically so. In 2005, the year this statistic emerged, I returned to Ireland to settle after 6 years working in South Africa. Uprooting wasn't a new experience. Upheaving, upping and going became a speciality, in fact, having been on the move since 5 months of age. For over 3 decades, I adapted to new worlds, accents, attitudes, ignoring the need to relax the roots. Feet always itching, ever hungry for the world, I was caught between the thrill of discovery and the desperate need to end the cycle of transience and abandonment which had defined me. Between wanderlust and a yearning for stillness, I was trapped by a merciless and incessant homelessness of the heart. Always on the outside, I'd become a pariah from normal life, a walking ghost state. In 1968, at 3 months, my parents moved to London, unable to further their careers at home here in Cork. My maternal grandmother took care of me until they settled and collected me 2 months later, and so it was that my life of world travel began, of identity travel. Come to sunny Zambia, caught my father's eye, in a newspaper, and soon we were airborne. I had my first birthday in Kitwe, where we became denizens of a young, closely knit expat community. We later moved to Lusaka and made lifelong friendships with families from Dublin, Down, Galway, Waterford, Limerick, and other counties. We were a 33rd county adrift, lived in a scorching, dusty microcosm of Ireland. Hayleys, hoolies, swimming and barbecues, even hurling matches filled my formative years in the dry heat of peaceful Zambia. A perk of my dad's job meant I would attend boarding school in Kildare. By 8, I was jet-setting thrice a year with my Irish African pals under the watchful eye of doting British Caledonian chaperones. I had become an actual adventurer, spending breaks with grandparents in Cork or with family friends in Dublin or Waterford. At the end of fifth class, I received a letter proclaiming I was to fly to South Africa. I never returned to Zambia or to school in Kildare and lost all contact with my friends, but the thrilling promise of new experience soon dulled any pangs of separation, a feeling I became very intimate with over the decades to come. I entered high school 2 years younger than my new classmates and clumsily, shyly passed 5 years in De La Salle High School, run by Irish brothers, to enter my matriculation year at 15. I was a firm, reticent outsider. After a year as a bank clerk, I was conscripted into the South African military at 17. where I served as a medical soldier. For almost 20 years after that, I worked variously in or traveled through over 24 countries, most significantly South Africa, England, Switzerland, France, Canada, and Japan, including counties Galway and Cork, and finally teaching in Port Elizabeth until 2005, by which time I had decided that Ireland was the only place that held any chance of settling me down. So I finished up at the Nelson Mandela University and headed back for the old start. Homelessness must have long entered and altered my DNA. The whole world at some point had become home. Not living for longer than 2 years anywhere had made a shapeshifter of me, a survivalist, armed with a broad range of experience and work history, over 50 different jobs, mainly contractual, including running my own multimedia company. With my pockets full of learning and languages, it soon transpired that I was overqualified for most positions, either that or I wasn't settled enough. After spending my last few bobs hunting for jobs, I turned to the state. The state had built around itself a wall of European habitual residency bricks, cemented with blanket couldn't-care-less laws and plastered with inept and negligent welfare administration. This new pan-EU law, Habitual Residency Condition, the HRC, meant I would not be entitled to assistance until I was back for 2 years. Within weeks, I was without means and was advised to rely on my Cork family until I was employed or the sentence served. I refused, had to appeal, and to do so, embraced homelessness. And while it was no huge deal to me personally, being unattached as I was and an 8-year-old adventurer again, I saw it as a rite of passage, paying my dues, and the perfect chance to acquaint myself intimately with the capital, not the real capital, of course. I spent the bulk of my days applying for work and researching my appeals at agencies like Crosscare, on free computers, at help centers or libraries, spent as much time in galleries and museums, libraries and parks, countless hours on the Grand Canal hanging with Paddy Kavanagh, hours on the Royal grumbling to be in. I read dozens of collections by Irish poets I'd never heard of and got to know a very different Dublin to the one I'd known as a schoolboy. That huge warmth seemed to have escaped the city somehow, souls splintered out into the suburbs. But I found the heart of Dublin beating as fiercely as ever along the benches of the boardwalk, at the homeless hostel dinner tables, at poetry nights and art exhibitions. I couldn't prove that Ireland was my centre of interest. The chief appeals officer from the HSC and their lawyer sat me down and told me as much, even after I'd appealed Scoyoga. The only Doyle Aaron member I contacted for help was then Deputy Michael D. Higgins. Within days, he seconded his legal secretary to appeal on my behalf. An appeal which, along with six others I made, was rejected outright. I managed to land an 8-week scriptwriting tutorship at Filmbase in Temple Bar, €100 per session, while sleeping rough, without their knowledge. My family didn't find out until 6 years later. It took 8 levels of appeal in as many months. Initially, I was let into homeless shelters. Many Cedar House on Abbey Street, super people, with the Asylum Seekers Unit throwing me a few bob each week. Later I was confined to the night buses, which might drop me at one of any number of temporary shelters, and was soon denied those too. My name entered a list of closed doors, and all this at the height of the boom. Ireland of the warm welcomes was now Ireland of the fuck off to wherever you came from and don't bother coming back, we have our own problems. Yes, too right you do. My eyes were wide from blatant xenophobia and racism, reminding me acutely of Johannesburg. Dublin sang with a strained, conflicted whimper shivering from its new sanctuaries within the souls of the dispossessed. Dispossessed, that is, by the nouveau obsessed. Most days I enjoyed a full meal at the Capuchin Day Centre, sometimes at Focus Ireland, at night headed for Stephen's Green for soup and sandwiches from Simon, who handed me an Arctic-ready sleeping bag when I eventually went completely rough. Thank the stars for Simon, for all people who give a damn. Without those truly concerned human Simon faces, my faith in humanity, in the world-renowned Irish humanity I had for so long been proud of, would have crumbled, and a cynical self triumphed. Most of my possessions, including backpack and passport, were stolen. I was offered showers and new clothes if I needed them in the life-giving homeless persons units. For those last 4 months, I slept under bridges, in doorways, in parks, sometimes on friends' floors, but most often at my favorite spot inside the Irish Life Building, beneath the vivid Sweeney Estray mosaic, which was sadly removed in 2013 for safety reasons after storm damage. It's where I felt safest of all during those uncertain months. I felt an affinity with the wandering Sweeney and that inner courtyard, where I'd clocked the perfect timing to slip under the metal doors before they rolled down at 10:30 p.m., promising me solitude until dawn, and where I was king of the party-covered courtyard and a cornucopia of barely smoked butts to top up my pouch with abundance. It was there I opened myself up to the stars, where I thought and felt and slept more deeply than I could remember. My health had taken a hit by the end of it. I was at my wit's end after the homeless unit turned a blind eye to an EU directive which had insisted the HRC be implemented more fairly by a certain date that February. It wasn't. So I hobbled up to the Ministry for Justice and spat on the plaque, deliberately getting arrested to qualify for legal representation. I wouldn't recommend this strategy generally, but it worked. 3 days later, the homeless unit phoned me to say I could claim welfare and rent allowance. I was finally home. And this is a poem that I wrote from that. Well, Home More or Less, it's, some of you have heard it. It's the title of my first collection, Home More or Less. And it's for the homeless. There lies all the time in the world in the stone of a winter doorway. The city has its own dream and talks in its sleep, softly. A low drone of summer bees in harmony somewhere far away vibrates just where my sleeping bag meets the ground. Wings ache. I've forgotten their purpose. Rest is the only prize now. And soon it is the dark morning, having only rediscovered stillness, the promise of that other world stirs, sweeping away the oh-so-close nirvana from this womb of generous sleep. I will return soon, soft stone, to whisper into your ears, into your tired ears, a blessing for that soul I may never meet, who left this fruit in the steaming tea. Thank you very much.